Today is Wednesday, August 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Taliban take control of a seventh Afghanistan provincial capital.
That also shows that they are determined to go ahead with their battlefield attacks and victories to put more pressure on the Afghan security forces.
Plus, a prominent U.S. governor resigns following a sexual harassment inquiry.
The best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing.
We'll have these stories and more next. The Taliban continue making gains on the ground in Afghanistan. The European Union official stating on Tuesday that the group controls 65% of the country. That comes on the same day that the Taliban took control of Puli Kumri, the seventh provincial capital, to fall to the group. VOA's Ayaz Gul is in Islamabad and joins us to discuss the latest developments.
Ayaz, Tuesday was another intense day of fighting throughout the country, with the Taliban reportedly taking control of yet another provincial capital. What do we know about the fighting that was taking place throughout the country?
Well, as we speak, just minutes ago, we received fresh reports that, in fact, Taliban have captured another district, which brings the total to 8 districts in the last 1 week that the insurgents have overrun. And that also shows that they are determined to go ahead with their battlefield attacks and victories to put more pressure on the Afghan security forces, who are already struggling to contain these advances, facing logistical problems and, in fact, unity problems.
Ayaz, a European Union official said that the Taliban now controls some 65% of the country. And on Tuesday, U.S. State Department spokesperson said that the violence in the country is not consistent with the deal reached between the U.S. and the Taliban. You know, as far as I can remember, the deal reached back between the U.S. and the Taliban was for a cessation of violence between the U.S. forces and NATO forces and the Taliban, not necessarily between the Taliban and Afghan forces, correct?
Yes, that was the ceasefire under the agreement was between the U.S.-led international forces and the Taliban, and there was no such compulsion or binding on the Taliban to stop fighting against the Afghan security forces. And, this agreement has been under criticism from the outset for this particular reason, that if there is ceasefire against the international forces, why not against Afghan forces? But Taliban have their own arguments to defend their military action. And the United States, Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has his own arguments. So it's quite a complex situation right now in terms of how this deal was struck and whether Taliban are fully living up to their commitments outlined in this document.
One other thing I want to ask you about is that the International Committee of the Red Cross saying that in its health facilities, it's treated some 4,000 people wounded by weapons during the past week. You alluded to, the impressive gains that the Taliban has made over the week. What do we know about the civilian casualties in the conflict during this past few weeks?
Well, Steve, this figure of more than 4,000 war wounded being treated in just 15 facilities across Afghanistan that the ICRC runs is shocking and is really devastating, because what we know from a UN report that was released last month about the civilian casualties occurring in the first 6 months of this year, and that was around just 5,000 injured and dead people that we were told documented by the UN mission in Kabul. And now, in just 10 days of this month, we are hearing, and we now, through the ICRC, we have come to know that it's more than 4,000 people, although we don't know exactly whether all of them are civilians or there are combatants from both sides that the aid agency has treated in its hospitals. But 4,032 casualties because of the war is a huge number. And that definitely confirms or strengthens the UN fears that the year 2021 could be the most devastating or deadlier year for this 20-year-long conflict. You know, there's fear more bloodshed is going to take place in this country with no signs of any positive development towards bringing the two warring sides to the negotiating table.
Aya, speaking of that negotiation table, the extended Troika talks are expected to get underway Wednesday in Doha, Qatar. Given the increase in fighting throughout Afghanistan, what are the expectations for those talks as the regional partners, the United States, United Nations, sit down to try and put pressure on both sides of the Afghanistan conflict to hammer out a peace process?
What we know is that the Taliban have repeatedly made it clear that any negotiations or any progress in these peace talks with Afghan government representatives is linked to the stepping down of President Ashraf Ghani and his government, and a new transition government must be put in place before any progress can be made in these negotiations. This has been the Taliban's position from the outset. And at the same time, we also know that President Ashraf Ghani has recently, in a nationwide speech and other addresses, made it very clear that he is the legitimate leader of the country. He was elected through constitutionally held elections. So if something has to happen, it will be Taliban joining his government, and only then there will be progress in peace. Now, these are the stated public positions of both sides. Whether these international and regional countries led by the United States, we know U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad is also there, will be able to impress upon these warring sides to really show some flexibility in their stated positions so that the peace process can be taken forward is yet to be seen. But what we understand from high-level briefings from officials even in Pakistan, that whatever the regional countries, including Pakistan, which has a key role in facilitating the peace process, whatever they do, it will be ultimately up to the Afghan stakeholders to come to an agreement. No outsider can really push for any solution, because any outsider solution imposed on Afghanistan has never lasted in the past. But what we are going to hear, and we understand from the meeting that is going to take place of extended Troika, is that once they hold their regular consultations, then members of the extended Troika, which are China, Russia, the United States, and Pakistan, will hold separate meetings with Taliban representatives and with the Afghan government negotiating team, which is also based in Doha. And maybe at one stage, they will all be in one room to discuss something, because things are really bad in Afghanistan. And if nothing urgently comes out of these consultations and negotiations, and both the sides do not return to the negotiating table, we're going to see more bloodshed and more violence in Afghanistan in the days and weeks and months to come.
Ayaz Gul reports for VOA from Islamabad, Pakistan. Iraqi refugees at the Al Hol camp in northeast Syria are voicing concerns about the growing violence inside the camp, which hosts thousands of people, including families of Islamic State foreign fighters. Over the weekend, an Iraqi refugee was killed, and three others were seriously injured in an attack by a suspected IS cell, bringing the number of those killed inside the camp to 25 since mid-April. Al Hol is the home to nearly 62,000 people, including about 30,000 Iraqi refugees. In March, U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces carried out a major security operation to curb attacks claimed by ISLs inside the camp. More than 125 suspected IS operatives were arrested in that campaign. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control has just added Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip to its list of places where travel is not recommended because of the growing rates of COVID-19. On Monday, for the first time since February, Israel documented just under 6,000 new cases,
almost 400 of them serious. The increase comes despite Israel's decision to give a third vaccination shot to all adults over 60. Linda Gradstein has more.
Israel was one of the first countries in the world to roll out a vaccine program and the first to offer a third shot to adults over 60. Despite that, the number of people contracting COVID-19 continues to climb. Professor Salman Zarka, Israel's coronavirus czar, says the country is approaching a critical point. He said that Israel is asking everyone who can to get vaccinated, not only for themselves, but as a sign of mutual responsibility. Zarka said it won't stop coronavirus, but more shots could prevent a fourth lockdown. Despite an intensive campaign, there are still more than 1 million Israelis 12 years old and above who are eligible to get vaccinated but have not yet done so. The rates are higher among teenagers and in the Arab community. A new Israeli study found that despite the Delta variant, vaccines provide a high level of protection. The study found that the rate of serious infection is 6 times higher in older people who were not vaccinated than in those who were. Israel is also trying to contain the Delta variant by requiring anyone coming into Israel, including vaccinated Israelis, to quarantine. Mark Feldman, the CEO of Zion Tours, told Israel Radio that the new regulations have frustrated many would-be travelers, leading them to cancel their trips.
They want to make it that from almost any country in the world, if you go there, you better be expected to do a 7-day quarantine upon your return here. They don't care that to get on any plane to come to Israel, you have to do a test. The government doesn't seem to care that when you land in this country, you have to do a test.
Feldman added that the government has made it all but impossible for non-Israelis to enter the country and has frequently changed its policy.
As much as the new government has tried, the problem is the policy changes day to day. So it's incredibly difficult to make plans both to travel out of Israel and to travel from Israel.
Israel has reinstated its green pass, meaning anyone who wants to enter a restaurant, a gym, or a hotel must either show proof of vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test. The government has also set up more than 400 stations around the country for rapid COVID-19 testing. Next month, schools are set to reopen, and there are several Jewish holidays when families gather and many attend synagogue. Some Israeli officials say another lockdown is likely then. Others say that if more Israelis vaccinate and wear masks, they hope serious COVID-19 cases will drop and a lockdown will be avoided. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
We now turn to Reuters reporter Gloria So, who updates us on COVID-19 cases sweeping across the United States.
Hospitals in the United States are filling up rapidly as the Delta variant sends COVID-19 cases surging to a 6-month high. The U.S. has averaged 100,000 cases for 3 days in a row, up 35% over the past week, according to a Reuters tally. That's largely due to Delta sweeping through unvaccinated swaths of southern states. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson said Monday only 8 intensive care unit beds were available in the state, while Texas Governor Greg Abbott asked hospitals to postpone elective surgeries for the time being. In Florida, which set a single-day record on Sunday with over 28,000 cases, according to the CDC, hospitalizations have been at record highs for 8 days in a row. That's led to renewed debate over vaccine and mask mandates. A growing number of top education officials have shifted gears, calling for mandatory vaccinations for teachers and mask mandates in schools. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced Monday it would seek the president's approval to require military members to get vaccinated. Louisiana, Florida, and Arkansas reported the most new cases in the past week based on population.
Reuters' Gloria So. The U.S. State Department announced on Tuesday that it was providing more than $50 million in humanitarian aid to Myanmar citizens who are coping with humanitarian crisis that was sparked by the February 1st military coup. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
This aid provided by the State Department and USAID will enable our international NGO partners to provide emergency food assistance, life-saving protection, shelter, essential health care, water, sanitation, and hygiene services to the people of Burma.
The coup in the Southeast Asian country, formerly known as Burma, has led to deadly anti-junta protests and clashes involving several armed ethnic groups and the ruling military government. This has caused shortages of essential goods and services and forced thousands to flee their homes. In the United States, faced with mounting legal pressures, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo resigned on Tuesday. Reuters' Freddie Joyner takes it from here.
And I think that given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing.
Amid mounting legal pressure and demands for his departure by President Joe Biden, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo resigned on Tuesday following an inquiry that found he sexually harassed 11 women. A startling downfall for a man once seen as a possible U.S. presidential contender. In a televised 20-minute address, Cuomo again denied any wrongdoing, though he said he accepted full responsibility for offending the women through what he characterized as ill-conceived attempts to be affectionate or humorous.
In my mind, I've never crossed the line with anyone. But I didn't realize the extent to which the line has been redrawn. There are generational and cultural shifts that I just didn't fully appreciate.
Cuomo, a Democrat who served as New York's governor since 2011, made the announcement after New York Attorney General Letitia James earlier this month released the results of a 5-month independent investigation that concluded he had engaged in conduct that violated U.S. and state laws.
The investigation found that Governor Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed current and former New York State employees.
The investigation, detailed in a 168-page report, found that Cuomo groped, kissed, or made suggestive comments to women, including current and former government workers, one a state trooper, and retaliated against at least one woman who accused him of sexual misconduct.
Wasting energy on distractions is the last thing that state government should be doing. And I cannot be the cause of that.
The 63-year-old had for months denied mounting allegations of sexual harassment and renewed those denials after the investigative report was issued. Like his late father, Mario Cuomo, who was also governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo never ran for president, despite speculation about his possible ambitions. He gained national prominence last year, delivering daily news conferences as his state became the U.S. epicenter of the public health crisis. His resignation spared Cuomo from possible removal from office through impeachment proceedings in the state legislature. Cuomo's resignation marks the second time in 13 years that a New York governor has stepped down in scandal, after Elliot Spitzer quit in 2008 over his patronage of prostitutes. Cuomo's resignation will take effect in 14 days, after which Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat from Western New York, will take over as governor of the state of more than 19 million people until the end of Cuomo's term in December 2022, becoming the first woman to hold the post.
Freddie Joyner reports for Reuters News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Australian scientists have analyzed the fossilized jaw of what they refer to as a fearsome flying dragon. Tim Richards and his team of researchers from the University of Queensland found that the jaw belongs to a new species of the flying pterosaur. The beast named Tabung Ngaga Shawi, which means spear in mouth from the language of the extinct Wanamara Nation who lived near where the fossil was found, and the last name of the man who uncovered the remains in 2011, Len Shaw. Richards describes the animal as having a meter-long skull, a spear-like mouth with 40 teeth, and a wingspan that spread to around 7 meters. The flying dragon is said to have fed on fish that once lived in the large and now extinct Erromanga Inland Sea in Queensland's outback region. The researchers' findings have been published in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Virginia Giuffre, an accuser of the late financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, has filed a lawsuit against Britain's Prince Andrew, alleging that he raped and sexually abused her several times when she was 17 years old. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, legal experts say that it is unlikely that the prince will have to appear in court anytime soon.
In the lawsuit, Virginia Giuffre, who is now 38, says Prince Andrew sexually abused her on multiple occasions when she was under 18 years old. The lawsuit alleges this happened during visits arranged by the convicted sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein, who committed suicide while awaiting trial in 2019. Giuffre's lawyers filed the civil complaint in the U.S. District Court in Manhattan under New York's Child Victims Act. U.S. law enforcement is conducting separate investigations into Jeffrey Epstein's crimes and his accomplices who allegedly helped to groom and traffic women and girls. Mark Stevens is a British lawyer specializing in international law.
In international law, you have to take any criminal cases first, before any civil case. So I think it's almost a racing certainty that this case filed by Virginia Giuffre to preserve her rights will actually be stayed until the outcome of the law enforcement investigations in the United States. And only then will it have an opportunity to go forward. But the best form of defense that Prince Andrew's lawyers have got is to delay, to obfuscate, to effectively argue over legal technicalities.
Prince Andrew has consistently denied the claims. As a member of the royal family, he is entitled to immunity from prosecution, says Stevens.
But of course, I think the case is calculated by Virginia Giuffre's lawyers to ensure that maximum public pressure is put on him not to invoke his right to crown immunity.
In the town of Windsor, west of London, in the shadow of the Royal Castle, many residents said Tuesday that justice should be served. Among them was truck driver Mark Lewis.
I feel if there are any, you know, underlying issues, then they need to be addressed.
Prince Andrew has already stepped back from royal duties. He has offered to help US investigators. Royal family analyst Richard Fitzwilliams.
There's some form of standoff on this issue, whether or not he's prepared, as he said he would, to cooperate with the FBI in their attempts to know more about Epstein's accomplices. The facts are, as far as been reported, that the FBI would appear to want some form of face-to-face interview, and that it may well be that Andrew has offered some form of written interview.
Later this year, Jeffrey Epstein's associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, is due to stand trial in New York, charged with procuring and trafficking underage girls. She has denied the charges. Again, Richard Fitzwilliams.
She was a close friend of Andrew's. If anything were to emerge then that we don't know, that will bring further embarrassment.
Meanwhile, it was announced Monday that a fund to compensate Epstein's victims has paid out more than $121 million to 138 people. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Ethiopian government appealed on Tuesday for its citizens to join the military to fight the Tigray People's Liberation Front in the embattled northern Tigray region. The TPLF, which ruled Ethiopia for three decades, now controls the Tigray region. After the fighting between the national government and the TPLF broke out in November, the United Nations says that about 4 million people in Tigray, Amhara, and Afar face emergency or crisis levels of food insecurity. Africa has a unique opportunity to develop its competitiveness through artificial intelligence, something that you may have heard once referred to as AI. That's according to a recent report released by the International Research Center for AI, which is under the auspices of UNESCO. FabSkill is a Tunis-based artificial intelligence startup that uses AI to recruit new talent for companies worldwide and gives traditional web recruitment platforms a run for their money. Africa 54's technology correspondent Paul Ndiho caught up with Bashir Afifi, the company's CEO, over Skype.
You have created a company that is trying to change how recruitment for talent is done in Africa, especially in Tunisia, where you are. Let's start there.
We are using artificial intelligence, but also we are using video so that we make the recruitment process more smooth. You know, here in Tunis and generally in Africa, we have a lot of problem when it comes to recruitment, a lot of person trying to find jobs, but also on the other side, a lot of recruiters saying that they are not able to find the good profiles.
How did you come up with the idea?
We saw a problem. And we say that if we bring tech to it, if we bring artificial intelligence and we bring the video that can resolve issues like mobility or availability of the candidates, we can bring something good, really good for us as a business, but also for our country.
It's fascinating to see this thing working in real life. How has the response been from the users?
Every new technology, there is sometimes a little of fear when it's something new, but from the both sides, from the users, the candidates, but also from the recruiters, you know, when you talk to a recruiter and say that you are bringing artificial intelligence, the first thing that came to their minds is that this man is bringing something that's going to steal my job. Yeah, but we had a lot of discussion with them, explaining that's only a tool that's going to help them to make the right decision, but it's also a tool that's going to speed the process, that's going to help them to spend less effort on the recruitment process.
In Tunisia, where you are, people still want to see the actual CV or the actual resume. They want to talk to the person to person.
That's right. But also, there is some cases where like what we are doing right now, when there is some problem of mobility, you know, when the persons are a little bit far from the job where the job is located, it become easier so that they can access and have the same chances as the other persons who are, you know, here in Tunis, we have a problem of centralization of jobs. A lot of jobs are in the capitals and a lot of persons are in other regions, and it makes them a little bit, it makes those jobs inaccessible for them.
When you talk about artificial intelligence, a lot of people would say that this is for big companies, not the small mom and pop shops, the startups that are coming up. So who are you targeting?
Here in Tunis, we have, as customers, we have two telco companies. We have a lot of leading banks as customers. But startups are, they don't have like big HR teams, so that they are interested in these tools as it's it boosts and accelerates their recruitment process, you know.
Going back to artificial intelligence, that's your bread and butter. How does it work? A lot of people have no clue what artificial intelligence or AI is.
We use scoring models that based on skills, qualification of the candidate, based on his experience, history, the jobs, and even the internship, the education and diploma. We try in a way to understand what's written in his resume and make this data readable for our systems.
A lot of people lie on their resumes or on their CVs. So how do you catch that?
That's a good question. I'm going to tell you about the first part. When for us, when a candidate creates his own digital profile, like he fills some forms about his education, about. In the other hand, we have also some technical, some assessment tools, some technical tests and technical quiz, so that we help the recruiter. Then the other side, for the recruiter, he has the ability to send during the recruitment process any technical tests so that he can make the assessment of the candidate.
Thank you so much for your time, Bashir.
Thank you very much.
Bashir Afifi is the CEO of FabSkill in Tunisia. He was speaking to Africa 54 technology correspondent Paulin Diho. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.